Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 14th of November. The UN Convention on Climate Change's 19th conference took place in Warsaw this week. And of course, there was an absolutely devastating, horrific cyclone that took place at the same time. The lead negotiator from the Philippines, Nadarev Sanyo, expressed thanks for the expression of sympathy to his country in the face of their huge national difficulty, Super Typhoon Haiyan. He said to anyone who continues to deny that climate change is part of the problem, I dare you to get off your ivory tower and away from the comfort of your armchair. I dare you to go to the islands of the Pacific, the islands of the Caribbean, and the islands of the Indian Ocean and see the impacts of rising sea levels, to the mountainous regions of the Himalayas and the Andes, to see communities confronting glacial floods, the Arctic, where communities grapple with the fast dwindling polar ice caps, to the large deltas of the Mekong, the Ganges, the Amazon, and the Nile, where lives and livelihoods are drowned. Nadarev is taking dramatic personal action.
In solidarity with my countrymen who are struggling to find food back home, and with my brother who has not had food for the last 3 days, with all due respect, Mr. President, and I mean no disrespect for your kind hospitality, I will now commence a voluntary fasting for the climate. This means I will voluntarily refrain from eating food during this COP until a meaningful outcome is in sight, until concrete pledges have been made to ensure mobilization of resources for the Green Climate Fund. We cannot afford a fourth COP with an empty GCF. Until the promise of the operationalization of a loss and damage mechanism has been fulfilled, until there is assurance on finance for adaptation, until we see real ambition and climate action in accordance with the principles we have so upheld. Mr. President, this process has been called a farce. It has been called an annual carbon-intensive gathering of useless frequent flyers. It has also been called saving tomorrow today. We can fix this. We can stop this madness.
And that's the question of this hour. Can we fix this? We have two guests with us during the course of this hour. James Cossin is an atmospheric scientist at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He also works with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. Later this hour, George Stone will be with us, instructor in the Natural Science Department at Milwaukee Area Technical College, co-chair of the annual Wisconsin Renewable Energy Summit. Jim is with us first. He has studied climate variability and climate change and the impact that it has on hurricanes. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour as we discuss how the Philippines has been ravaged by this typhoon. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Jim Cossin, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
It's hard not to see the TV images of how so many people are sick and eating. Well, they have nothing to eat. They're drinking bad water. All the buildings have been leveled. The homeland is pretty much gone. And to listen to this delegate to the climate change conference and not weep more than a few tears. From your study, as a person who's an atmospheric scientist, when you saw the ravages of this typhoon, you probably saw it in some scientific way that the rest of us perhaps did not. Did you?
Well, sure. I mean, we'll always look at it in various contexts. The question of climate change is always going to be underlying what we see, especially when we see something as anomalous, as extreme as Super Typhoon Haiyan. And that will always raise questions about whether this is some type of harbinger of things to come under global warming. And so that is the sort of thing that we are studying very actively right now.
The remarkable thing is that it was less than a year ago that the Philippines experienced another typhoon where thousands of people died as well, last year.
That's right. And I think it was in 2009 they were hit by quite a few tropical cyclones that year as well. So they're very much in harm's way there. And the the demographic pressure, you know, just more people there and more more exposed infrastructure is always going to have an effect on you know, just the overall risk and exposure that they have there.
Mm-hmm. So this UN conference and this delegate from the Philippines were looking at what they could do to keep these kinds of events from happening again. Is there something that we can do as human beings on this planet to keep this from happening?
Well, I think that the short answer would be no. I mean, the tropical cyclones have always been a part of the climate system before human beings ever started to affect the climate system. And the Philippines has always been in a region of, you know, a fair amount of tropical cyclone activity. There's certainly not much that we can do about that. It's much too strong of a force for us to try to go against. And going against what Mother Nature wants to do is almost always is going to backfire. So in terms of, you know, climate weather modification, things like that, those are not necessarily good ideas. So the short answer is that there's nothing we can do to keep this sort of thing from happening. But again, when we put this into the context of climate change, then we have a sort of a different question. We have a question of, are events like Haiyan becoming more likely with time? And that's really the question that we strive to answer. It's very difficult to attribute climate change to any single event. And most people have probably heard this before. It's a subtle but an important distinction. The individual events, it's difficult to implicate any one cause, but we can say that overall and over time, that climate change is expected to cause this type of event to happen more often. And I think that that's what the delegate was probably referring to more than anything, is that we need to curb emissions and we need to reduce the effects of humans on climate in order to keep this from becoming more likely. But there's no realism in the idea that we'll make this stop.
Mm. When you say more often, have we not reached a point in time where more often is now?
Well, I think that yes, absolutely. More often is now. Not everything is a projection. It's part of an ongoing time series, so to speak, where things will get progressively more likely. So, yeah, are things more likely to happen now than they were 100 years ago? It seems that they are. We don't have particularly good data to really say that definitively, and there's a lot of uncertainty. But there's lots of suggestive evidence to suggest that that yes, it already is more likely than it was 100 years ago.
And when you talk about climate change having some impact here, can we be more specific? What is it that we might be doing that would lead to the intensity of these kinds of storms?
Well, that's a great question, and there's more than one thing that we're doing. I think the most talked about aspect of climate change is CO2 and greenhouse gases, just human-caused greenhouse gases. And we have a pretty good idea of what that type of global warming does to the tropical environment, which is where these tropical cyclones live and die. And what it does, essentially, is it raises the limit on how strong these typhoons can become. We call that the potential intensity. All other things being favorable, this is how strong the storm can get in this environment. And so when you add CO2 and you warm the tropics, one of the ramifications of that is that you increase this sort of speed limit. And that does not mean that every single storm that forms will reach that speed limit, but they have the potential to. And so over time, you will expect to see stronger storms getting stronger.
So when you say warming the tropics, you mean warming the water? Is that what's crucial here?
Well, that's certainly a large part of it, yes. But that's not the only thing that tropical cyclones respond to. They respond to the entire atmospheric column that they sit in. And actually, the temperature, if you think about hurricanes as kind of a big engine that, you know, have an intake near the ocean surface and an exhaust very high in the atmosphere, the temperature where the exhaust is happening is also very important to how strong a storm can become. And so when we look at how global warming is affecting this potential intensity, we have to look at more than just the sea surface. We have to look at the entire atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Was this, we heard that this may be the strongest storm ever in the whole history of the planet. Is that true?
Well, the data is still coming in, and these things are usually settled after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of information that comes in during the storm, and then there's a lot of data collected after, and then there's a posterior analysis that's done where everything's collected and assessed, and they sort of provide their best estimate. One of the issues that we have in that part of the world that we don't have here and, you know, on the United States coast is that they don't fly aircraft into hurricanes or tropical cyclones the way we do. And so they don't really have any sort of ground truth.
I see.
And everything is sort of estimated from satellites and any sort of information that they can get their hands on. So there's always going to be a little bit of wiggle room in there in terms of things. But there's absolutely no question in anyone's mind that this is certainly one of the strongest tropical cyclones ever recorded.
As we look at the complete devastation of some of the islands, obviously it's a matter of getting people food and water and getting some people out of there as soon as possible. But eventually you have to decide, well, what are we going to do with these islands? Are we going to build more homes here? And how do we have any faith that we're not rebuilding something that's going to be hit once again? Don't you think that? Wouldn't you have to think that as you're deciding what the future will be?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that would come under the broad heading of adaptation. And that you know, there are ways to mitigate the risks. And a lot of those have to do with building codes. Florida is a good example of the sort of the post-Andrew building codes and just things like, you know, tie downs that hold roofs on, something as simple as that during construction. And so there's a number of things that can be done to sort of mitigate the risk. There's not much we can do to mitigate the physical hazard, which in this case is the tropical cyclone, but, you know, better building practices and, early warning systems that are more effective, things like that. But it's very difficult in that part of the world, I think, to realize all these things in any kind of a time frame that we would like to see, which is immediate.
Right. The Philippines delegate we heard from at the top of the show said in that speech, cutting greenhouse emissions is more than just a matter of money. He said that it was urgent, that it is a matter of survival. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. Well, we're certainly heading in the wrong direction, and places like the Philippines are more likely than not going to come under greater and greater risk and become more and more vulnerable with time.
And so where is the sense of urgency? Do you see it?
Do I see the sense of urgency?
Right. Do you see people acting on this in any significant way?
Oh, I see. Never enough. No. There's meetings and there's talking, and I'm part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We just had our fifth assessment report is coming out, and we're hoping that this will help to galvanize governments to action. But there's an awful lot of inertia in the system, and human pleas notwithstanding, there's also unfortunately, and this is not my purview because I'm a scientist and not a politician, but there certainly are pressures from companies that stand to lose money if CO2 emissions are reduced. So, you know, there's that unfortunate side of the capitalist machine. So the short answer is yes. I see lots of action around me, and certainly the last few years of us working very hard on the fifth assessment report is a great example of many people working very hard to make a difference. But it certainly has been a slow process, and unfortunately probably will continue to be a fairly slow process.
Well, maybe those of you who are scientists in this area need to have second careers as politicians.
Well, okay. I'll think about that one.
Well, yeah. I hadn't thought about that before. So what do we take away from this typhoon? Just what are the questions as a world community we need to ask right now?
Well, I think the most immediate thing we need to ask right now is what can we do to provide aid more quickly now and in the future? Mm-hmm. Those are the immediate issues that we have are very clear. You know, if we step back and say, what can we do to mitigate this or at least alleviate things to some extent for the future, then I think certainly aid to help with the adaptation process is a great place to start. It would be, there's probably various protocols within their weather service that could potentially be improved upon, in terms of early warning. So there's a number of things where we could, and when I say we, I mean the scientific community, could become more involved, but the doors have to be open to that. And I know that there's been an awful lot of people reaching out within the scientific community since this event occurred, and forecasters from the National Hurricane Center trying to get in touch with forecasters in the Philippines and sharing of information. So there are a number of bridges that we could improve.
Thank you so much for being with us at the beginning of our show. We appreciate your time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I guess the first part of the show, Jim Kassin, he's an atmospheric scientist at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is also on that intergovernmental panel on climate change. We're going to continue our conversation. We'll start taking phone calls as we move into our further discussion here. George Stone will join us momentarily. He is an instructor in the Natural Science Department at Milwaukee Area Technical College, co-chair of the annual Wisconsin Renewable Energy Summit. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. The big question of the hour is, we have experienced probably the most severe storm in the history of the planet. What can we do? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. George Stone is our guest now. George is, as I said, instructor, Natural Sciences Department at MATC here in Milwaukee. He's also author of The Ethics of Climate Change Adaptation and Mitigation. He's attended and presented at national and international conferences on climate change and has been on excursions in Iceland and Norway examining what climate change has done to those parts of the world. Again, we'll welcome phone calls. They're coming in. Email is talk at WPR.org. George, thanks so much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. What's your response when you see the utter devastation of what is probably the worst storm in history? You're a guy who's studied climate change for a long time. Is this the result of it?
In part, yes. Climate is the context in which these extreme weather events occur. And the warmer temperatures, especially the SSTs, or surface to sea temperatures, to which you referred, leads to increased evaporation of water vapor into the atmosphere. That water vapor provides the moisture for precipitation, as well as the latent energy for driving the storms, for their energy. And so certainly, it's kind of like let's say a correlation between smoking cigarettes and heart disease. You can't relate a specific heart attack of an individual to smoking, but you can look at the overall trends whereby the frequency of heart attacks among smokers and the earlier age of heart attacks among smokers is much higher than it is among non-smokers. So you can make the trend correlation, although you might not be able to make the specific connection for an individual. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I see we've had so many extreme and record-breaking weather events of late. Yes, I certainly think that the context of the more moist atmosphere, the higher temperature, and the advent of these is related. And climate change provides, as I say, the context for weather events.
I've made a lot of mention, and we heard some of this, Philippines lead negotiator to that UN conference this week, simply because he was so moving, I thought, and started a hunger strike to have something done about this. He said in a fairly lengthy address that developed countries should have been taking the lead in combating climate change in the last two decades, and we're at a point now where it's not enough to avert the crisis. We're responding to the crisis now. Are developed countries to blame here for what's going on? And is there, as our first guest said, a kind of an inertia in developed countries that we just, for whatever reason, just can't seem to move on this, and we really need to move on this?
Well, your first guest, Jim Constant, is absolutely right. I mean, there is an enormous amount of inertia, both in the economy, which drives a lot of the policy decisions that are made, but certainly we have a moral obligation. And the suffering of those people in the Philippines and in many other extreme weather events that have occurred in the last year and recent years at an increasing rate, I mean, we do bear responsibility because I don't like to use the word blame, but let's put it this way, that the Western democracies, the developed countries, including the United States as one of the leaders, the Industrial Revolution is what has provided the additional carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, changing the planet, the composition of the entire planet's atmosphere, and which provides the context and the drive for global warming. Since we put the gases in the atmosphere, we've taken the carbon out of the ground where it's been naturally sequestered for millions of years in the form of oil and coal and natural gas. We've taken that carbon out of the ground, burned it, put it into the atmosphere in which it's holding in more heat, providing this warmer climate and the prospect, increasing the probability and the potential of these extreme weather events. We put the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, so we bear some responsibility. And we should be taking the lead internationally because of that. In addition to the fact that we have a moral responsibility to do so, this seems to get ignored so much. All human endeavor has a moral component, and I think that we need to address our responsibility to our brothers and sisters around the world and to future generations, our children, our grandchildren, and up to seven generations, as the Native Americans tell us.
Let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. John in Richland Center. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. My father survived the worst typhoon in naval history. He said his tugboat rolled like a barrel, and 12 men were in the pilot house crying and praying. We lost three destroyers. As you can remember, I was wondering, how does this typhoon compare to the one in 1944, which my father survived in?
We just lost our connection with George, so we'll try and get that once again and see if he remembers the typhoon of 1944. As our first guest said, this part of the world is subject to typhoons. The question is the intensity of these storms and how absolutely devastating they are now, and this one is the worst ever. So we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. More of them. I'm sorry, we just temporarily lost our connection. 800-486-8655 is our number. And you can also use emails, too, and a Facebook address. We'd like to read your comments on Facebook, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. I don't know if you heard all of that, George. His father survived a typhoon in 1944 in the Philippines. Are you aware of that one?
I've seen that referred to in some of the papers I've read. This recent storm, Haiyan, is one of the most severe ever recorded. So it's right up there in the top one or two. And so I would suspect that it was at least as severe, if not more so, than the 1944 storm.
Let's go to Dan in Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for having the show. We have two things we can do. We can adapt and we can mitigate. We can do a lot of adaptation by ourselves in our own communities. But to actually mitigate the effects of climate change is going to take national action. The president has moved. He has done some things about emission of carbon by power plants. There is some action over there. But to have a greater impact on our society, what we need to have is a revenue-neutral carbon tax on the carbon that's emitted by oil and gas and coal when we burn it. And when we import it into the country, the tax could be applied there. When we get it out of the ground, the tax could be applied there. And the thing that's been holding that back, as your previous guest mentioned, was there are economic impacts from that. The fact of the matter is, though, that if we made that a revenue-neutral carbon tax, if we took the money at the pump and started it with a small amount of a tax and then had it grow year by year and had the money returned to the citizenry instead of going into the federal government, I think that might get a more cooperative atmosphere going in Congress. And we have to do something, as George just said, about future generations as well as the people all over the world.
George?
Well, that's the approach that's recommended by James Hansen, Jim Hansen. He's attended our Sustainability Summit, which will be in next March in Milwaukee, twice, and made this a very strong point. And the group that is promoting this is called the Citizens Climate Lobby. It makes, in many ways, the most sense. And the idea is that the carbon fuels would be taxed at their point of origin, and then the revenue that's generated by that, rather than being spent on some government programs, would be returned to the citizens as a rebate. And so this would be a way of selling it to the public and making it quite popular. But I think it's a very good idea, and it's called a carbon tax, and I think that's one of the solutions. The thing of it is, the fossil fuel companies, those who produce coal, oil, and natural gas, are right now they're subsidized by the taxpayers because they can write off their exploration for oil and gas off of their taxes, despite the fact that they're making tens of billions of dollars of profit each year. Taxpayers are subsidizing. That makes the marketplace uneven. It's an uneven playing field for alternative forms of energy, such as renewables. Also, there are all these ill effects that come from burning fossil fuels, such as mercury in the fish, soot particles causing asthma, not to mention the pollution of carbon dioxide, which is causing the planet's climate to warm up and increasing everything from diseases in the tropics to extreme weather and climate events, droughts and heat waves and water shortages and food shortages. And none of that damage is being paid for by the companies that are causing it. So if we started to charge them for these externalities, stop the subsidies, this would also help greatly, because this is a long-term problem, and your caller is quite right. Mitigation is the answer to the long-term problem. The short-term problems, we're going to have to adapt to.
Thanks very much. And are we better at doing that? Are we better at adaptation?
Well, we've got to do both. Adaptation, the New York City, for example, a year ago, Superstorm Sandy, the storm surge associated with that as a result of the intensity and size of the storm as well as rising sea level broke the old record for New York City by 4 feet and flooded all the subways and all the tunnels except for the Lincoln Tunnel. What are they going to do? They're going to have to put some kind of a storm surge barrier up to prevent that happening in the future. Extremely costly, but those are just immediate and short-term things that we have to do. That's a necessity. Long-term, in order to prevent catastrophic effects, and I'm talking about the basic necessities of life around the world, water supply, food supply, health, preventing tropical disease spread, for this we have to have mitigation. We just have to cut the greenhouse gas emissions very severely. And scientists generally agree we want to try to keep the overall temperature increase below 2 degrees Celsius, which is just under 4 degrees Fahrenheit. And to do that, the estimate is we need to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by mid-century. That's a very tall order. We haven't begun to start to address that. Instead, we're encouraging the expansion of dependence on fossil fuels right now with the fracking boom.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, we're not doing much of anything, either at the national level or internationally.
Or internationally, yeah. Let's go to some emails. Mike from Madison asked, is there a man-made way to reduce water temperature?
Well, water temperature is in exchange with the atmosphere. And as the atmosphere warms, that heat is transferred to the water. And what we've discovered recently is that a lot of that warmer water is finding its way to deeper levels. We used to think that the increased ocean temperature was restricted to the surface. Now, recent research has found that it's finding its way down to deep levels, indeed all the way down to the bottom of the ocean. And the heat capacity of water is enormous. And this is bad news because it means that all this heat is being stored and it'll be around for a long time. the best way to stop that is to reduce greenhouse gas and stop the atmosphere from increasing in temperature.
Cornelia Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi. I couldn't agree more with what was just said, and I would like to make a little pitch for creating more political will. I am a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby, which lobbies, just like everybody else on Capitol Hill, for the carbon tax. And our organization has grown by leaps and bounds over the last few years. But also, in Wauwatosa in particular, myself and some neighbors are working on educating people in our city. And we have green neighbor work groups to create more individual will for people to change the way they live. So I think there, people just in general feel powerless and think it doesn't matter if they use 10 more plastic bags and create more garbage and, you know, have do not change their light bulbs. All of those things add up. And we're trying to work really hard within our city with various groups and organizations to educate people about that so they don't feel like they're totally powerless.
Mm-hmm. Do you have time or do you have to get the doorbell? I'm just wondering what kind of reception you had in D.C.
Excuse me?
What kind of reception did you have in Washington as you lobbied?
I did not go there, but some of my friends and colleagues did, and,
uh-huh.
and they were very fortunate to actually speak to members of Congress, and I think they were seen by five or six. I'm not sure because,
okay.
I didn't go last year.
Right. All right. Thanks, Cornelia, very much for the call. Does it make sense for people, considering the unresponsiveness of government nationally and internationally, does it make difference for people to use better light bulbs or to watch out for their amount of trash and not use plastic bags? Does any of that make any difference, George?
Sure, it all makes a difference, and those are all positive things to do. But they're not the long-term answer. Ultimately, we're going to have to exert enough political pressure to get some public policy decisions made that make sense, that recognize the problem, address it, and deal with it effectively, providing sensible solutions. So, you know, a lot of times they say, well, the politicians don't really understand the problem. There's all this negative propaganda about the validity of global warming. This isn't true. I mean, the politicians do understand. It's just that they're contributors and the people with political clout tell them not to do it. And the one thing that's more important to politicians, even than contributions and money, is the prospect of getting reelected. And until the time comes when we can build enough political pressure, public pressure on the politicians so they think they might lose the next election if they don't vote the right way on this issue, then we're really not going to get much done because the propaganda machine against change is just too powerful right now.
Pat in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi. About 10 years ago, I read a book. I believe the title was called High Tide, and it really impressed me because it was written in a very accessible way to non-scientists. Just the average person could read it. And it deals with changes in daily lives of people all around the world. And that could have been anything from furniture and tables that were so tilted because of the tundra thawing that people could no longer use them to put their cups and saucers and plates on. It dealt with drinking water. It dealt with storms. But they were all stories that I had never heard. But it really impressed me because it was people dealing with this now. And I read that about 10 years ago.
Are you familiar with it, George?
Yes, I am. And the impacts of global climate change caused by humans is so widespread and affects so many aspects of life but I want to return and reemphasize that the most important, if we prioritize these impacts, the most important are the way in which it affects water supply and food supply. You know, about 1 in 7 people in the world right now don't have access to potable water, to safe drinking water. About the same statistic applies to sufficient nutritious food supply. And that's just getting worse. The impacts of climate change are exacerbating all these problems. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the Pentagon, our own Department of Defense, lists climate change as a national security issue. In its most recent four-year report in 2010, it listed climate change as a national security issue, and I think that will come out again in 2014 even more so. Because when people become displaced, when they have to migrate, when they don't have sufficient food or water or living space, this produces environmental immigrants. It destabilizes the local political structure, and this political destabilization eventually leads to conflict. So this is a very fundamental issue worldwide.
Thanks, Pat, so much for the call. Let's go to Ron from Facebook, who writes, let's remember the solution is solar and alternative energies, not a carbon tax on companies that won't change their message and will just pass that cost on to us. So let's look at renewable energy and alternative energies. Where are we in that regard?
Well, it's not either or. It's both. We need to make the fossil fuel companies pay for the costs of their fuels. And the costs of their fuels, as I mentioned earlier, are very widespread, whether it's polluting the water. You know, you can't eat most of the big fish in Lake Michigan anymore because of the high mercury content. You can't live near a coal-fired power plant because of the high asthma rate. And worldwide, of course, carbon dioxide is changing the climate with all these ill effects. But it's not either or. We need both. We need to make the fossil fuel industry pay for the unintended consequences. They may not be unintended. I mean, they keep on doing it. They need to pay for those so-called externalities. And we also need to level the playing field and subsidize renewable energy so that that can be developed. And Germany gave us a great example 25 years ago. They started subsidizing photovoltaics or solar electricity, and they were soon leaders in the world. So it's not either or. We need to do both.
Well, you know, the thing that's discouraging about all of this, George, and you know this better than anybody, is we've been talking about this renewable energy for years and years and years and years.
Well, that's right. And sad to say, the current political climate in Wisconsin is not particularly favorable to renewable energy. I mean, the wind development in the surrounding states has far outpaced Wisconsin. In recent years, the surrounding states, Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, have developed a lot of new wind energy. Finally, a project was approved by our Public Service Commission here in Wisconsin. But the last couple of years, we've had virtually no development of new wind energy, in contrast with the surrounding states. So we need to get our own house in order here in Wisconsin. But, it's a sad state of affairs when the opposition to climate change as a driver and the opposition to renewable energy development is winning the war. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to make our voices heard. People need to be active. And I feel quite strongly that the scientific community, needs to be more outspoken on this issue. I mean to say it's society in general that supports their research, that supports the universities and the institutes. The scientists owe it to the society that supports them to tell it straight to the public and to tell it straight to the politicians. And I think we need to hear more from them.
George Stone, our guest this part of the show, instructor in the Natural Science Department at MATC. He co-chairs the annual Wisconsin Renewable Energy Summit. We're looking at the aftermath of this incredibly damaging, heartbreaking typhoon in the Philippines and been described as the biggest storm ever. Climate models suggest that these kinds of storms will be with us more frequently over the coming decades. And it seems to me as though we've already seen many of them in the last few years. So what do we do about it is the question of the hour. We have one line open if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Yesterday, we talked about the alarming achievement gap among Wisconsin students in reading and math scores, and it left us wondering what it is we can do to improve the quality of education in our state. The National Quality Education Conference taking place in Milwaukee next week, and we'll have two of the keynote speakers with us, the superintendent of schools in the Pewaukee School District, which has just received a national award for quality. And we'll also speak with the founder and president of Hope Foundation, a nonprofit that works with schools and school districts on improving educational quality. Back to phone calls for George Stone. Mike is next in Wausau. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I'd like to ask your guest, as far as fossil fuels and the generation of electric power, the quickest way to move away from fossil fuels would be nuclear power. Although it's not renewable, it could be done quickly. And, of course, we let that all fall apart in the 70s after Three Mile Island and that insipid movie by Jane Fonda that told us we were all going to perish. So I'll take my answer off the phone or take my his reply off the phone.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Well, you're right. That is an alternative fuel. The reason we haven't had any development is because people are scared of it. They don't really understand radioactivity. They know that it's a hidden danger, and so development has decreased. We lost one power plant here in Wisconsin. Jim Hansen used to advocate what he called fourth generation nuclear power, at least as a standby. One of the problems with that is it requires an enormous investment to develop a new power plant, especially one up to the latest standards of safety. So there's an economic inertia there, a reluctance to invest. And the other problem, of course, is the disposal of radioactive nuclear waste. Nobody wants to ship it or send it across country by train. Don't send that stuff through my state. And, you know, the federal government had hoped to use Yucca Mountain out in northern Nevada as a repository for nuclear waste, but then there were volcanic and earthquake hazards pointed out by geologists. Nevada decided maybe they didn't want that in their state after all. Other states didn't want it going by rail through their states, and so that whole repository scenario died out. And now all the nuclear waste is being stored on site. So the fear, the safety issue, which really is not that great because, I mean, France has a lot of nuclear power plants. Israel has a lot. The new generation of nuclear power plants are quite safe. But that's a holdover, as you say, like from the movie China Syndrome. But it's that fear, I think, more than anything else that's keeping development, along with the problems of huge investment and storage of the radioactive waste. I think we need to go in the direction of renewable energy. There's far more sunlight out there than we can ever use. There's a lot of wind, especially offshore wind on the Great Lakes and offshore in the oceans, and we need to start developing that in a serious way.
Well, I hate to be on a broken record here, but we've been talking about that for years. Ralph Nader brought that up a long, long time ago. You can't tax the sun. Well, what happened to solar energy? That was 50 years ago we're talking.
Well, we didn't follow Germany's lead and subsidize the new young industry so that it'd get firmly on its feet. Plus, we're subsidizing fossil fuels, as I said earlier, so the playing field is uneven. If we'd even the playing field, charge fossil fuels for the damage they do, stop subsidizing their exploration, and instead start subsidizing the new clean energy high-tech, the innovative technologies that are going to provide renewable energy, then we'd be ahead of the game. But the fossil fuel industry is blocking all of that. We can't even get the Congress to renew the production tax credit for wind energy for a long period of time, and that's one of the main reasons that further development hasn't occurred in Wisconsin. So I think that as the risks of the impacts of using fossil fuels, such as the risk of severe storms, the risk of prolonged heat waves and droughts, which have affected Wisconsin in recent years, when the dollar costs of those risks are tallied up and people begin to realize that how much it's costing them to continue to use fossil fuels, then we can maybe start to swing the pendulum in the other direction.
Thomas in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, what do you think of the link between solar flares and then the weather patterns here on Earth? I've been hearing that on the news recently. And what are your thoughts? This is jumping over to renewable energy. What are your thoughts on Stark Industries and Tony Stark's approach to that?
What's Tony Stark? Who is he? I'm sorry, I don't know about him. Thomas?
No, I don't know about Tony Stark or his proposal either. I wish the caller had explained that is. I haven't heard about it. As far as solar flares and the sunspot cycle, the impact that that has on temperatures on the Earth's surfaces and the Earth's energy balance is very, 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 very small. It's not a serious factor at all. And as a matter of fact, that's been disproven many, many times. The principal cause of the increasing temperature on planet Earth is the increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas and traps the back radiation from the Earth and holds it in. The Earth's energy balance is out of balance. We're absorbing more energy than we're radiating. Let me put it this way. Our energy comes from the sun, and then we radiate on the night side of the Earth, it radiates back into space. The greenhouse gases absorb a lot of that back radiation and hold it in to the planet, hold it in the atmosphere. And so the energy balance has been upset. And we've got an energy balance so that the heat content of the atmosphere, and which is much is transferred to the oceans because the water has an enormous heat capacity, that's out of balance. We're holding in more than we're radiating back out, and it's going to cause us to continue to store more energy in the Earth's surface, in the atmosphere, and water. And until that's corrected by reducing the emission of greenhouse gases, we're not going to make any progress on this problem.
Bill in Somerset. Hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
Yes. One comment is that I think while I'm in favor of everything we can do to use renewable energy and reduce our greenhouse gases, it's absolutely a useless effort for us to be doing that because China and India and all those countries are increasing faster than we can reduce. And they are showing no sign, they're slowing down slightly, of really reducing the amount of greenhouse gases they're emitting. So the water's going to rise no matter what United States and Europe does.
No, I disagree strongly with that. They, as Kathleen pointed out earlier, they point to us and Western Europe as the cause of this problem because we developed the Industrial Revolution. We burned all the coal and now all the oil and natural gas, and we're not doing anything about it. You know, in decades, in previous centuries, starting at the end of the 19th century, the United States was a world leader in conservation, now we call it sustainability, and in environmental responsibility. We gave the concept of the national park. We passed the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and all the rest, and led the world. And since we're one of the major causes of this problem, we can't exert any leverage on India and China unless we exert leadership now on the most serious and challenging environmental issue that's ever come before humanity. We have to exert leadership. Then that gives us leverage with them. And by the way, China is investing far more than the United States in renewable energy technologies. They're going to be ready because eventually this transition is going to have to be made. It's the more gradual it is, but the sooner we start, the better. But they're going to be way ahead of us because we're not investing nearly as much as we should.
Thanks very much, Bill, for the call. George, thank you so much for being with us. These are really unnerving events, are they? They just, if you look at the devastation, it's so sad. It just shouldn't be happening. And if we're contributing to it in some way, we got to change it.
Sustainability Summit, it'll be March 26 and 27 in Milwaukee, and Michael Mann, one of the leading climate scientists in the country, will be our keynote
Great.
Speaker.
Great. All right. Let's book him for a show. Thanks, George. George Stone, he's an instructor in the National Science Department at MATC, co-chair of the annual Wisconsin Renewable Energy Summit. Thanks to Robin Cherry and KP Whaley for production of this program. Thanks for all of your calls. Leave more messages on Facebook. We like to read them and have a citizen dialogue about this all-important issue.